Welcome to Forests, Folklore, and Fantasy. My name is Kelly, but I write and publish under my initials as K.M. Rice. Whoever you are and wherever you happen to be listening from, I want to thank you so very much for giving me some of your time and to let you know that you are most welcome here. Today, I am going to be introducing a holiday that thankfully is still alive and well, despite its incredibly ancient origins, and that is the holiday that we know as Beltane, or perhaps you have heard of it as May Day. For those of you who will recognize the term May Day, you will know that that is the 1st of May. But in terms of the wheel of the year, if you indeed are walking the wheel of the year or perhaps studying the wheel of the year, which again is a Reconstructionist, neo-pagan belief system, it's a way of marking the seasons of the year and the transitions through moving through different holidays that are all directly tied to the agricultural calendar of Europe. And the wheel marks the two solstices, the two equinoxes, and the midway points. So Beltane on the wheel of the year would land directly in between the vernal equinox or the spring equinox and the summer solstice. Beltane is a holiday much beloved in pagan, neo-pagan, Druid, Wiccan circles. It's traditionally the first start of summer celebrations. Usually the weather is warmer, the world is green and thriving, and rituals and celebrations can be held out of doors. So it's very much the start of the holidays that are about expansion and going outward, whereas starting around Samhain or Halloween, even before that, even I'd say Mabon after the autumnal equinox, I consider that to be the season or the half of the year that is the hearth and the home, because most of our traditions, and I am speaking about the Northern Hemisphere, but most of our traditions are about going inward and coziness and togetherness, whereas the traditions for the light half of the year from the vernal equinox onward are about going out into the world, dispersing, reveling in space, and still having togetherness, but it isn't focused on convening. And there's a very simple explanation for that, and that has to do with climate. I won't say too much about that because I think it's fairly self-explanatory. Beltane is particularly special, though, because it's one of the holidays near and dear to my heart, for it is one of the four Celtic fire festivals. In other words, it is one of the four festivals to mark not only the agricultural year, but also the pastoral year. And what I mean by that is when I speak of the agricultural year, I and others are primarily referring to farming, to sowing and harvesting and being stagnant in terms of one spot of land that's being tended to. Whereas the pastoral year refers to usually hoofed animals, ruminants and cattle, so that would be sheep and goats and sometimes pigs and oxen, animals that rely on grazing lands. And the pastoral year followed a calendar of driving those herds into greener pastures. That's where the expression comes from. And then as the grasses begin to die and there isn't as much grazing land for the animals, then they would be brought back into Bower and Byre and kept safe throughout the winter, and also cold. And cold, not as in they're cold, C-U-L-L-E-D. So people like to use the term harvested these days. I find that really odd. You don't harvest an animal, you slaughter it. That might make some people cringe, but it is the grim reality. And I believe, out of respect for the life being taken, it's important to use the proper terms instead of trying to sanitize it by saying it's being harvested, just like a shaft of wheat is being harvested. The conversation that could be had around plants having a level of awareness is fascinating to me, but I believe that goes beyond the scope of this conversation. Perhaps that's something I should touch on in another episode, but suffice it to say that there is a growing body of research that shows that grasses, at the very least, can, I don't want to say see, but we don't have a verb really in our language to explain what they are doing, because they don't have eyes, but they do have receptors for color and for the world around them. So we're fairly certain a lot of plants, if you're standing next to them, can at least sense that something is there, and perhaps what color trousers you're wearing, which is remarkable to me. But that came to mind when I mentioned harvesting grain, because you could make the argument of, well, you're also ending, you know, the life of a being when you're harvesting grain. And you know that's true. And in that spirit, I think we should honor all of our sources of sustenance and where they come from. And really, that is the impetus for almost every single holiday or festival that Indigenous European people practiced. It was a form of honoring their food. Just saying that sounds lighthearted and silly to me, because we don't view food in the same way that our ancestors or the before folk or Indigenous communities did, because we have a fairly significant level of food security. But food meant and still means life and survival. So it's no trivial thing. We're not honoring a McDonald's French fry here. We're honoring the life force of the earth through our bodies, and thus the life force of ourselves and of our communities. So Beltane would mark the beginning of summer, proper summer, when the sun is reaching its zenith and the days are getting longer, they're getting warmer, and plants are thriving. If you should have already sown fields at that point, if you were living in an agricultural lifestyle, and those fields would be coming to fruition, you would have some promise of food security in the future. And in terms of the pastoral year, this was traditionally the time that herds were taken out of Byre and driven to the greener pastures that I mentioned. Those greener pastures in Ireland and Scotland, and I believe as well in the Isle of Man, were often places considered to be the highlands. And I should say in regions of Scandinavia as well, they practice this, or at least used to practice this form of raising livestock. In fact, in Switzerland too, in a lot of places, the livestock would be driven to these pastures, and it was a monumentous event, because if you're going to ritualize something, you're of course going to be inclined to ritualize something that's incredibly important to you. And going through these motions of ensuring your survival by looking after your investments, which would be your livestock, then it makes perfect sense that these periods of time would have been ritualized. When I said earlier that it is one of the four Celtic fire festivals, if you've been listening to this podcast since its inception, its beginning, that will probably sound familiar to you because I already had an episode giving a little introduction on the holiday known as Imbolc. And that traditionally is celebrated around the end of January and the very first few days of February. The other fire festivals of the Celtic realm would be Lunasa, which is a little less widely known just because it's not quite as extant in Celtic or Gaelic communities. And then Samhain, which is still very alive and well, especially here in the United States, under the guise of Halloween. And as I said, these festivals marked key moments in the agricultural or pastoral year, but it is very likely that they at least date back to the Paleolithic era. In the Paleolithic era, people were trying their hand at domesticating livestock and domesticating grains, and they would have lived alongside several of these animals. And just given human nature and our dependence upon the weather and the seasons and the climate, it also stands to reason that an observation of sorts around this time of year is probably almost as old as we are as a species. I learned something really fascinating the other day. I know I've given this statistic to help put things into context before, and it is that 90 to 99% of our time on this planet as Homo sapiens, as a species, all that time we were largely hunter-gatherer societies, and that it wasn't until the agricultural revolution of roughly 10,000 years ago that we ceased being hunter-gatherers. But to put that into further context, all of history that we know of is actually incredibly recent because we have existed for roughly 30,000 years. Recorded history only goes back a few thousand years, and archaeological history only goes back a few thousand before that. That leaves a huge, huge stretch of time, again, by far the vast majority of our time as people, the same people in the same bodies, using similar languages as we do today, that's just unaccounted for. And I'm deeply fascinated by those people and how they lived and how they interacted and how we got to where we are now. And to my dismay, we just don't have a whole lot of clues. Our bodies and our anatomy gives us clues, and so does our diets and our nutritional needs gives us clues as to how those deep ancestors likely lived. But from there, we can only speculate about how they may have structured their societies. So if anyone tells you, including myself, if I, you know, lose myself and my passion over talking about these ancient customs, if anyone tells you, oh, yes, we've been celebrating this since the dawn of time, just know that it's possible that something like this was occurring, but that no, you can't trace a holiday specifically just like Beltane in its current form all the way back to the quote unquote dawn of time. I probably didn't. I think you're supposed to say unquote after you finish the part in the quotes, but anyway, I am digressing. One of the reasons I get excited over Beltane is because it did carry with European immigrants over to what they called the New World, which would be the United States and Canada. and up until fairly recently was largely celebrated in England as well, I should say. But it was largely celebrated still, at least in schools. My mom's generation grew up having a maypole and decorating a maypole. And that was gone, at least in the part of the world where I live, that wasn't happening when I was a kid, which is a shame because it's such a beautiful, lovely, colorful, vibrant, festive tradition. The holiday is also still very extant in Ireland and Scotland. Scotland is host, Edinburgh in particular, is host to the biggest Beltane festival in the world, as far as I know. And it's called the Beltane Fire Festival. It's held on Calton Hill, just, I suppose, on the outskirts of Edinburgh. I've been to the hill. I've been to the location. I have always wanted to go to this festival, but unfortunately have just never quite made it. I was there a few days after the festival back in 2022, the last time that I was abroad. But I don't mean like abroad, like New York slang. That's probably derogatory and I probably shouldn't even be saying it because I don't even know it because I'm not a New Yorker and I'm not from New York. So I don't know why I'm talking like that now because I feel like I'm just insulting people from New York. But abroad, as in out of my country, I missed it by a few days. And this festival, you can look up more information about it online if you're curious. It makes no claims to be an ancient tradition or to be trying to revive an ancient Gaelic tradition, but rather it is inspired by. And from what I understand, it is part performing arts with a sort of theatrical component and part ritual with lighting a fire, lighting a bonfire the eve before Beltane. It's also wonderful to know that there are multiple celebrations and festivals held in Ireland to mark Beltane. One of them is in County Kerry in Dingle. There is a festival to celebrate Beltane. I think it's a week long, and it's a arts and music and, I believe, food festival. And so if you happen to be on the Dingle Peninsula that time of year, I imagine it's a wonderful festival to attend. In Irish, it would be called Bealtaine. And there is a pagan component. I know that they have some mumming, which you may be unfamiliar with that word, but you've likely seen depictions of mummers before. It's the traditional form of guising by taking straw, long shafts of straw, and fastening them into a conical shape and then placing that cone on one's head to disguise their features and also making some sort of body costume with the straw as well. So I know that there's mumming at this festival. I think the pagan part, I think they light a bonfire, perhaps burn some sort of effigy. I'm unclear on that. And just have general fun and revelry. And even though I've been to the Dingle Peninsula many times, that's sadly a part of it that I haven't been able to attend yet. So that's on my bucket list too. But sadly, I can't be in Scotland and Ireland at the same time. Beltane or Bealtaine is mentioned in some of the earliest Irish literature. Therefore, like Samhain, which is also mentioned in some of the earliest Irish literature, we can infer that it was a well-established, well-practiced, well-known holiday in the culture at the time that the piece of literature was recorded. And since this was a time of change and transition, it was a period of like I said, celebration, but also a lot of trepidation. And there were a lot of superstitions around these transitional times or liminal times. I'm just going to take a moment here to define the word liminal, because I use it a lot, and I probably should have done this quite a while back, but it's not a term that's often used outside of philosophical or academic circles. So the word liminal means occupying a position at or on both sides of a boundary or threshold, or relating to a transitional or initial stage of a process. So liminal means you're neither here nor there. We are neither in the light half of the year or the dark half of the year completely, according to the old beliefs on both Beltane and on Samhain. Both of those periods of time, which are 6 months apart, roughly, were, and in some places probably still are, seen with suspicion. Because if you're not here and you're not there, and we're not fully in one season or fully in another season, where are we? And if there's a doubt about where we are, if there's some sort of weakness in our understanding of where we are and in this shift, what can come through instead? That might sound like a strange question, but to provide even more context, most Indigenous European peoples believed that we had our realm of existence and that we were not alone, that there were multiple realms, multiple realities, if you will. And the best way I could describe it based on my understanding is that they were layered. So there were multiple realms layered upon our realms, and sometimes the inhabitants of those realms, also in Irish folklore referred to as the other world, could bleed into ours. And even though the land of fairy, the other world, was an idealized place, in the same way that Alfheim, or the home of the elves, is idealized in Nordic or Scandinavian cultures, it's a place where the sheep are fatter and the grass is greener and people are more beautiful and you can be young forever. In Irish folklore and mythology, that would also be Tírnanog. And even though those realms sound so appealing and wonderful, the entities that dwell in those realms are not always so wonderful. In fact, fairies, contrary to our modern Victorian depiction of them as these beautiful, dainty pixie women with wings, fairies were actually quite feared. A fairy was not an entity you wanted to cross paths with, in much the same way elves were not really anyone you wanted to encounter if you lived in the north. To the point that both cultures developed such a superstition about them that they didn't want to mention them by name. I'm not sure what movie, probably in the 50s, popularized this, but a lot of Americans think that you refer to fairies as the little people. That's actually a mistake, because you should never draw attention to their diminutive size unless you want to incur their wrath. So if you're trying to be respectful, you wouldn't refer to something that they could be self-conscious about. So traditionally, they are referred to as either the folk or the good people. In Scandinavian regions, the elves, who again are quite similar to fairies, are referred to as the huldufolk. Actually, that's in Iceland. The hidden folk, the people we can't see. And the whole process of them becoming physically smaller is fascinating. We don't have an exact answer for it, but the theory is that their size shrank as Christianity became the predominant faith that did not allow the existence of these beings in its canon, in its cosmology, and that somehow this phenomena happened with a lot of different pre-Christian deities and creatures, that they literally became smaller. But before that, most of the folklore that we can access, and again, a lot of it was recorded probably in the 1700s, 1800s especially. So we don't always have access to the oral history and the oral folklore from before that, but it does seem to be that the elves and the fairies originally were no different than us. They weren't necessarily small. That's a much more modern interpretation, indeed a post-Christian interpretation. So I'm bringing that up because it sounds a bit laughable to be afraid of, like, these small little beings. Not beans, beings. I mean, I would genuinely be terrified of beans. If a bunch of beans, like dried beans, jumped out of a bag and started chasing me, like, I don't even think I'd try to step on them because, like, I would have no comprehension of what I was messing with. But beings, yeah, I'd be freaked out if a little, like, tiny person came out and started talking to me too. But even scarier if someone my size stepped out of a tree and had this ethereal beauty and this uncanny otherworldliness and did things to my mind, because they usually can more or less hijack a person's mind. They're so enchanting. That led me to behave in a way other than how I would normally behave. That's eerie. And the belief was that in these transitional periods, these liminal periods of time, again, Beltane, so the start of May, and Samhain, the start of November, which mirrors Beltane in a lot of ways because it was the period of time that the herds would be brought in for the winter. The belief was that these otherworldly beings could step into our world and wreak havoc. And that, as such, we needed to be on guard and prepared to deal with any mischief or deaths that they might cause. And part of their superstitions to ward off these evils in Scotland was known as Saining, which was a form of ritualized protection. Often this came in the form of plants. Specific plants would be hung over barn stable entries and homes and things of that nature. There's a lot of them that we still know about. In fact, if you're interested and you're listening to this at the time I've released this episode, which is mid to late April, I do have a course on Beltane available in the offerings section of my website, and it will be available for a few weeks. And it is a deep dive into the folklore and rituals of our Indigenous European ancestors or before folk. So if you want to know more specifics about some of these customs, do feel free to check that out. But suffice it to say, it was as much a joyous time as it was a time when people moved with apprehension. And that continued until very, very recently. I'd say the last 100 years, the last century, saw the fading of the fear associated with Beltane and May Day. Thank you. in Germany, which is usually considered a Germanic region, hence the name, though there was some crossover and bleed in times past with Celtic culture, so we do see some back and forth and some similarities there. In Germany, traditionally, this night is known as, forgive my pronunciation, Walpurgis Night, a night of witches, and the people celebrated in much the same way with bonfires, but the fear was less about interference from fairies and more about witches. So as you can guess, this is a much more modern concern. And similarly to the way that fairies and elves have been diminutized over time and literally shrunk, a similar theory says that as fairies were not an acceptable part of a Christian cosmology, the order of the world according to Christian religious leaders, they were replaced by otherworldly supernatural beings who, at varying times in the history of Christianity, were said to exist, and those were witches. And I say at varying times because I find it fascinating that for most of the history of the Christian faith, witches were laughed at. That was the concept of someone being a witch was just considered nonsense. And it wasn't until a certain cataclysm of events that happened in the early modern period that, again, I just feel like I'm plugging my courses here. Again, you can learn about in due time in October in my course on Samhain and the history of witchcraft. You can find out a bit more about what was the catalyst that started this massive shift in the Christian cosmology and worldview to suddenly decide that actually witches are real and they are a threat. So now I'm saying that, but I'm saying that's official doctrine. Who knows what was happening in parishes and local parishes? There could have been parishes that believed in witchcraft and witches, and certainly people in communities that believed in witchcraft and witches long before it became part of, again, the official doctrine of the era. And we also have documentation of people dancing around bonfires and seining with the ash and the smoke of the bonfires for Beltane. In Scotland, in certain regions, again, not to ward off the fairies and protect them from the fairies, but also witches. So the theory there is that what once was fairy, what once was fae or the folk, at some point shifted to become witches. Because again, they were much more acceptable and palatable to the locus of power, of religious power at the time. And Walpurgis Night, or Walpurgis Night, takes it a step further, and it was said to be the night that the witches would gather on a particular mountain in Germany and hold their witches' Sabbath. So not only were the seasons going through a transition, the livestock and the herdspeople going through a transition, because they would accompany their livestock to these new grazing lands, or not new, but seasonal grazing lands. So too, it was said, were the folk of the other world, or witches, which it depends on how you define a witch. Often, oh gosh, witches are complicated. I don't even know if I should get into it. Witches were often seen in European history as being mostly women who were your neighbors. You could interact with them. They were women, but that they had this duality to them. They had this like alternate version of them, that the spectral form that could leave their body and go do these deeds, like fly on a broom or fly through the air to the witch's Sabbath. And sometimes they believed the woman actually got out of her bed and left. Other times it was this spectral form, perhaps soul, that traveled and participated in these things. So there was a fear that if you were unaware, let your guard down, and were out on Halloween night or Beltane Eve, that you could get caught up in one of these liminal spaces. And who knows if you'd ever be seen again? Who knows what would happen to you? Who knows what curse or ill luck would befall your family, your farm? It was a very unnerving time. A great deal of Indigenous European rituals and festivals involved fires, especially bonfires, for some incredibly practical reasons. It gives a focal point to the festivities, a place for people to gather, a place for people to dance around. You can cook on it. A lot of times communities would take a brand of this fire, a brand as in a burning brand, a stick, and use that to light their home fire or their hearth fire, and it was sacred. It was blessed by the spiritual leaders in the community. And also, fire is incredibly integral as an element if you consider the fact that the sun is also more or less fire. And these before folk understood that connection. They may not have been able to describe to you exactly that the sun was a burning ball of gas, but they understood that it was heat and that it was light in the same way fire caused heat and light. And especially in these more northern climates where the growing season is wet and potentially overcast and short, it was incredibly vital to do what you could to honor that source of light and nourishment for your community, and to indeed attempt to lure it. So there are theories that these customs arose around bonfires, not only because of how practical they are, but also because they were a way of invoking the sun, of courting the sun. And it's documented that people would often dance around them sunwise, so in the same direction as the sun moved across the sky in an arc. And this is fairly consistent throughout many different European cultures for different holidays at different times of the year, that there was a lot of honoring and worship of the sun, especially in Slavic cultures. It was very much the focal point of spiritual guidance as well as of nourishment that they understood that if they did not have that, they didn't have anything. So if you haven't heard of Beltane before, or perhaps you had a casual knowledge of it, but perhaps not the breadth of how there's evidence that it was celebrated in some form under some name in different parts of Europe, then I hope that this served to whet your appetite. I hope it was a fun introduction to you. I apologize for meandering a bit down these little academic asides, as I am prone to do, but if you're a longtime listener of this podcast, that will come as no surprise to you. But overall, I hope your takeaway is that Beltane is the welcoming of the start of summer. Beltane is the welcoming of the green and the green world, to the point that people would gather greenery and make wreaths and different shaped objects from the greenery and use it to honor the green in the world by bringing it into their home or hanging it on their door or perhaps leaving it for a loved one. A tradition that went on in England until very recently was to leave a growing thing like a potted flower on the doorstep of the girl you liked. And my grandmother here in the States can recall on May Day, sometimes there would be a flower pot on her doorstep. And it wasn't necessarily, oh, I'm interested in you. It was just a friendly, lovely gesture. So I love when these very old traditions and very old holidays find a way to morph and still continue to exist in our societies. And I would love to hear from you if you have May Day celebrations where you live. Perhaps there's a community maypole. Perhaps the tradition of gifting greenery is still around. Perhaps there's even still a communal bonfire, or maybe it's being revived. So please let me know. You know where to find me. All my social media haunts and links are in the show notes. But yes, I would be fascinated to learn what is in your family and your traditions and your culture and your part of the world. So as ever, thank you so very much for your time and for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't hesitate to follow this podcast and share it with a friend who you think may be interested. One last time, I will mention that my course, Beltane, The Fires Are Lit, is available now in the offerings section of my website. I will link to it below in the show notes. And of course, thanks is due to the very talented Lane Thomas, whose track, The Village, is used in every episode of this podcast. And that comes from his fantasy-themed album, The Lands Beyond. I would also like to thank my wonderful patrons. Your support means the world to me. And also, while I'm at it, everyone who's bought one of my novels, written a review for one of my books, recommended it to a friend, made a purchase off of my Etsy, or perhaps even taken one of my courses or signed up for one of my live events, I so appreciate your support. As I said in my last episode, sometimes I don't quite feel like I have the external markers and validating features to feel like I am doing enough and that I am making a difference in people's lives and in the world. And of course, I struggle with the doubt that what I'm doing even matters. I think that's a very human thing. And I think that there's a lot more to be said other than what I said in that episode, Being Good Enough, which is the title of the episode. I think that just scratched the surface. But I just wanted to take a moment to express my gratitude to everyone who has supported me in any way and let you know that you're seen and valued. And I just, it warms my heart and it helps me continue to be motivated to keep doing what I'm doing, like producing episodes of this podcast. So thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, may your hearth be warm and your heart be full.